Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are in a bit of a roll. They're both from Dublin, have been friends for more than 30 years. And this friendship has been complemented by a working relationship that has seen them working together in some of the most exciting and successful Irish films of recent years. This weekend, their latest film, What Richard Did, opened in cinemas across the country. In 10 weeks' time, they start filming Frank, their next film starring Michael Fassbender and Donald Gleeson. And they've worked together on other recent successes, including Garage and Adam and Paul. Ed Gunn, he always wanted to be a film producer, and he's had great success with projects like Oma or Pure Mule for television, or The Magdalene Sisters and The Guard for cinema. Lenny Abrahamson started his career in theoretical physics, switched to philosophy, but has found his niche as a critically acclaimed film director. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Listen, is the theoretical physics useful in your career?
It has, unfortunately, absolutely no use whatsoever. Except it looks good on a CV. That's its main function at this point.
It looks great. You just immediately think you must be super clever.
I was joking with somebody a while ago that as a kid, I was really concerned for people to think I was very clever. It was my kind of USP. So when I was deciding what I should do in university, but I think part of the draw of theoretical physics was that that's the thing that really clever people do. I mean, I absolutely don't regret doing it, but unfortunately it doesn't come in so handy these days.
Where did you both meet, Ed?
We met, I think, at sort of various parties around South Dublin. When I was a kid, I was in school in Gonzaga, and it was a sort of tradition, which I presume is still maintained to this day, that Gonzaga boys hung out with Alex girls. That was just the way it was in those days. And Lenny's sister Emily was an Alex girl, and I met her, and I had one of those very intoxicating 3-week affairs with her at the age of 14, and that's how I met Len. I met Lenny through Emily, and because the school that Lenny went to, high school, they used to hang out with Alex girls on the other side as well. So we all met in that kind of,
in those heady, you know, it's like Berlin in the 30s. I think I kind of bunked into those parties, because I don't think high school boys were. I think the Alex authorities thought the Gonzaga boys were more appropriate.
There were no authorities around.
Connection for their sort of girls. But I used to go to the parties because my sister was there. She was that crucial sort of a year and a half younger than me. So all her friends were good girlfriend material for me when I was a teenager.
And then you met in college again, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, we used to know each other then, I suppose, from the age of 13 or 14. And we'd meet at these parties and chat occasionally and got on well. And then, yeah, we both went to Trinity. I think you were there a year ahead of me,
yeah.
In fact, weren't you?
Yeah.
And when I was coming into my second year in college, I had an idea to set up a film production society. Well, it was really a video production society. And this was in the early days of home video, when it was mind-blowing that you could actually get a video camera and video somebody yourself, and you wouldn't have to go through an incredibly technical, difficult process. And Lenny and I, we used to talk about films, I mean, as we met. And so I knew he was interested, and so when I was thinking about setting up the society, the first person I called was Len.
And I remember getting that call from Ed. Had Ed not set that society up and called me, would I have really made that jump into thinking about film later? And it turned out to be later, but that was the sort of thing that put me thinking about making films as a real way of living. And I may not have actually done that had Ed not set up that or had that idea.
I suspect you would have, actually, because you were so interested in it.
I had lots of things I thought about doing. I did think about writing, and I thought about, also I was kind of interested in staying within academia, although probably ultimately not that seriously interested in that. But yeah, you never know what would happen, because when I finished college, I took a year out and we made a film, you know, properly, this short called Three Joes, which Ed produced and I directed, and lots of the same people that I work with now, like Stephen Rennox, who's a composer that worked on Three Joes, I still work with. So that was the first semi-professional thing either of us did.
What was Three Joes about?
Basically a silent comedy about three blokes called Joe living in a flat in Rathmines, a flat that Lenny now lives in and is his house, in fact. We filmed in the same place that he lives in now. But the three Joes were Gary Cook, who's in Après Match, Michael Murphy, as in M-I-K-E-L, M-U-R-F-I, who is a well-known theatre director and actor, and Dominic West, who then was in The Wire, all of whom were, some of them were in college with us and others we knew. The first thing I ever commissioned was Three Joes, and I commissioned it from Michael West, the playwright, now the playwright, who was also a contemporary of ours in college, and I paid him 100 quid back in those days to write a script for me.
So and Ed also did this thing, which he's never done since, which he thought was very producerial, which was that he actually told me, you know, the big thing when you're shooting film is how much stock do we have, how many roles have we got, because you're aware of that as a director, especially when the budgets are tight. And Ed held back, I think, about three roles, which some senior producer told him was always a good move with the director. Hold back a few roles. Don't tell them you've got them, you know. Bring them out in an emergency. I remember I was really indignant about that. That was probably our only spat, actually, in 30 years.
So that was your first moment of being a producer?
I mean, I'd obviously done bits and pieces in college and we'd done stuff together before then. But that was the first thing, I suppose, that was, as Lenny said, sort of professional. I went out into the world in a big way.
Were you the director on it?
I was the director, right. Yeah.
So you went into your roles.
Yeah, we did. And it was the first time I'd really directed drama, actually. I'd done little things in college and bits before that. But it was the first time we had all the kind of apparatus of a drama shoot and dealing with crew and it was incredibly nerve-wracking but very exciting. And yeah, you have to start at some point. It's a bit like jumping into the 40-foot, you know. At some point you have to make that leap, but it was a happy experience.
Is it harder though, because you were in college in those days and you did that film, but when you leave college then straight after that, it's not that easy to make it, is it?
No, and that's why it probably took me, I mean, I suppose because of other aspects of what I was trying to do and where I was in myself, but it did take me a long time to come back around to making films. Ed, you did really continue on and make stuff straight away.
I mean, the thing that was interesting about that time was that, you know, we actually made Three Judges just after we left college, as it turned out, and it was 91 or 92. You know, on the crew there were people like John Moore, who was the head electrician on the crew, who's since gone on to have a huge Hollywood career, and Damien O'Donnell, who's a very well-known commercials director and filmmaker, was also on the crew. PJ Dillon, Hugh Linehan, who's now working in the Irish Times. So there was a bunch of people who were kind of, we were all interested in making films, and we were kind of, all, and obviously no one got paid in those days. But when 2 years later, the Irish Film Board was established in 1993, there was already a kind of a groundswell of people who were interested in thinking about making a career in cinema. Yeah. And really, until the Film Board was re-established in 1993, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't feasible.
I mean, I actually remember, I think the year that we made Three Joes, I think there were maybe two or three short films made here. And that was the sum total. I don't think any features were made that year. I think that was the sum total of film production in this country at that time. So it was a really bizarre and marginal kind of activity at that point.
But you were still into your theoretical physics. Well, actually,
I was
you
in
moved
philosophy at that point.
From
yeah.
that to philosophy, didn't you? And you went to Stanford University.
Yeah, so when I left college, I applied for lots of different universities in the States. I was really interested in philosophy, and I was kind of involved in it, and I was very torn about what I should do. So I applied for a few colleges. In the end, I got some offers and decided to go to Stanford. And I think even when I was going, if I'd been really honest with myself then, I probably would have said, I don't know if I'm going to stick it, because it was a five-year PhD program. In a very beautiful but ultimately quite Stepford Wives-y kind of California, where, I mean, as anybody who knows me would tell you, I'm a pathetic drinker. You know, I hardly drink, but in Stanford I was considered this sort of bousy Irish crazy, like I was some kind of Brenton Behan, because I might have like two beers after. You know, it was a very particular kind of place.
And did you stick it?
I didn't. I stuck it for half a year, and while I was there, I remember Ed calling me. I was living in a trailer off campus, as you do. I was writing an essay, and it was late, but it was different time and back home. And Three Joes had just won Best European Short Film at the Cork Film Festival. And they were all incredibly happy and high and having a really good time. And I was sitting there in my trailer writing my essay. And I remember thinking, I'm not in the right place.
You're a bit sad, probably.
I was a bit. I think I was a bit homesick there as well. And although academically it was really good, you know, in every other way it wasn't. And, you know, it is sort of ironic that I left California and came to Dublin in pursuit of a film career. But nevertheless, that's what made sense. That's where my little tiny home filmically was at that point.
Do you remember that call when you were talking?
I do remember it. Yeah, no, I do. I was just trying to recall, what did we have mobile phones in those days?
No, it was from a phone. It was from a phone box. Yeah.
Cork was a very important, it's still very important, but it was a very important film festival for short films in those days. And Three Joes had done well internationally. It won, you know, good prize at Oberhausen in Germany, and had won at a couple of different places. But to win the European Short Film Prize was, yeah, it was.
And I remember thinking, you know, maybe this filmmaking lark isn't such a crazy idea. Maybe I could consider doing it.
Yeah. And then yours took off quite quickly, didn't it, Ed?
It's interesting because you kind of look at sort of recessions and recessions. And when I left college, it was definitely the days of the milk round, you know, where all of my contemporaries, they went and, you know, met kind of employers from London and inevitably went off. And I was among the few that stayed here. And I was involved in theatre a little bit and had a real interest in film and a real interest in getting into film. Even though that didn't necessarily make much sense, but I just sort of had an instinct about it. And the first film that I was involved in was a film called Ailsa, which was based on a short story by Joe O'Connor and also written by Joe O'Connor and directed by my great friend Paddy Brannock. And and that, you know, that was the first thing we did, and it actually did well. It won prizes internationally and, you know, made an impression. And it was, I suppose in those days, it was such an exotic thing to be making films out of Ireland that we were able to get quite a lot of international support for the films that we were trying to produce and a lot of international finance. So even, you know, back in the days of Ailsa, it was funded by French and German broadcasters, and it was obviously, there was some Irish money in it as well. So it was kind of, that in some ways dictated a path that I followed for many years after that, which was to kind of make films from Ireland but using international financiers. And, you know,
it's hard to make a living though initially, isn't it, from making films? And I don't mean this as a criticism of you both, but the fact that you came from, say, quite privileged South County Dublin, did that help? Because maybe if you had no money and no money in your background, you simply couldn't exist and do it.
I think when you're that age, you don't think about it. I don't think that you think about harsh realities like how easy or hard it's going to be to make a living when you're in your 30s and 40s. I think you just go into things because they feel instinctively right.
I know in my case, because you worked for, you got jobs and things like that. I mean, I've never had a job, you know. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. So at the beginning, you know, it was a scholarship when I was in college and things like that. But my parents did help me in the first few years when I came back and nothing much was happening. I think I still would have done it even if that hadn't been there. But so it's very hard to say how your background interacts with your choices. But I'm sure that support was at that point certainly pretty crucial.
You know, I worked, the first job I ever had, proper job I ever had, was working for John Kelleher and David Collins, who ran a company called Strongbow back in those days. And I made a 7-part series on the environment for RTE. And that was literally just when I'd come out of college. So as you say, I was kind of, there were these opportunities. It was not just the Irish Film Board, but also the opening up of RTE. The independent production sector was growing. So you could kind of team tag between, if you like, your day job and then your kind of passion projects and developing projects as well.
Do you know at the beginning of a film whether or not it's going to be a success? For instance, something like The Guard in your case, Ed. Lots of people saw that film. It was a big Irish success. Did you know it would be a big hit?
It's very hard to know what's going to be a success or not, except that when I read that script, I thought it was a terrific script and I could imagine it being a huge success. You know, I mean, you know, certain things you can look at it and go, well, there's every chance, unless we really mess it up, that this could be a big success. And when you have interest from the likes of Brendan Gleeson and Don Cheadle, and you kind of marry that with the text of the script of The Guard, which was a brilliant screenplay. It was just, it was hilarious. It was very funny. You can easily project that maybe you'll have a hit, but you can always mess it up. That's the thing. I mean, that's the, you know, that's very, very possible. Once you get into the heat of making a film, the complications and the personalities and the sort of clashing visions and all of that stuff can come into play, and you can actually also mess things up.
And there
easily.
Are films which, you know, there are films which I have seen which I thought were going to die, and I've seen them when they're finished and they've been huge successes. And I've seen films, I've looked at projects where I think that's actually really good. And it's, you know, it's a film that should appeal to a public, and nothing's happened. I think you feel at the end of a project, if it works and people are interested in it and like it and go to see it, I always get this, my big feeling is relief. You know, there are so many variables in filmmaking. There are so many ways in which you can kind of ruin it or not grab it, you know, not get to the core of it, or otherwise somehow lose hold on it. And then there are all these unknowns about when it comes out and what the weather's like that weekend and how the press write about it. So there are so many ways in which these things can go wrong that it's an amazing feeling of kind of relief when it works.
Was Adam and Paul the first big project film you did together, really, after the Three Joes?
It was, and together. Actually it came about, I mean, another a very important relationship I've had is with a producer called Johnny Spears, who's a commercials producer. And yeah. So in that gap when Ed was making those first films he made, I had come back from college and I was trying to write, and I was getting very caught up in stuff that I was writing and throwing it away, and time was passing and I was getting more and more anxious that I'd made a terrible mistake. And I decided that what I really needed to do was actually start to shoot things, because, you know, as a director, you it's not like being a writer where you can sit down and write even if nobody cares about it. As a filmmaker, you really need this infrastructure, and it's hard to practice, it's hard to do your thing. So I decided I was going to try and make commercials, which was also, in a way, a good antidote to the, I think, rather over-serious self-perception I had at that time. So I started to make ads with Johnny, and I made sort of ads for Carlsberg and lots of big brands and you know, budgets which were, I remember an ad I made for Carlsberg had double the budget for a 60-second commercial that Adam and Paul had for a full feature film.
Is that the one, you know,
with the taxis
did.
And yeah, exactly.
It was
if
great
Carlsberg
ad.
Did nightclubs yeah. and those ones. So Johnny actually bumped into or met Mark O'Halloran, who's the writer that I've worked with a couple of times now, with, and again, a very important relationship and Mark had this idea for a film about two guys, Adam and Paul, and we started working on it together, and then got Ed involved as well. And that was a very natural way of us beginning to work together again. And then it was very natural to move on and make Garage with Ed. So,
which is another brilliant film we'll talk about. People kind of get what a director does in the movie, but explain to people, what does the film producer do?
I mean, the
very good question, Miriam. I've never been able to work it out.
I actually don't know myself sometimes, to be honest. I mean, people always think of the cliched film producer with a big cigar and bags of cash, and I neither have bags of cash nor do I smoke a cigar. But I suppose in a way you're kind of like an overall project manager for a film. I mean, you start out, you very often the idea starts with you, and very often you're the last person to kind of be involved with the idea before you hand it over to the audience or the distributor. And so you do everything. It's you nurture a project when it's in development, when it's at a very kind of early stage, you know, and might be, you know, a notion that comes to you from a writer, then maybe attach a director, bring it to actors, bring it out to the marketplace, raise finance at that stage. And once you've raised the finance, then you have to make the film and really deliver to the people who've paid for it the film that they expect, really. That's, you know, and all that goes with that.
Is it a bit of a nightmare, though? Because in other words, you have to deal with all the headaches as well. You have to be a counsellor, a psychologist. Do you find that difficult?
Contrary to what people think about the industry on the outside, most people are actually pretty decent, and most people are in it for the right reasons, and most people want to make the very best thing possible, and very often the kind of behavior that people sort of manifest sometimes is coming from a desire to do something really good and just feeling a bit exposed or a bit insecure, and so in a way part of the job is to try and make people feel safe, to build an environment around people where they can try things out, where nothing is for keeps, where you can, you know, you can play and actually discover the very best incarnation of what we all hope for.
You like working with Ed, obviously, not just as a friend, but as a good producer. What makes him a good producer?
There are lots of qualities. It's one of those jobs that you find very few really people who are really good at, because it combines a number of traits and skills. The producer has to be calmer than you. You know, like a director has to look fairly certain of themselves in front of absolutely almost everybody in the production, from crew, cast. But with the producer, you've got to have somebody that you can go to and talk really candidly about what your concerns are, and know that they'll be there for you. And so trust is a huge part of that relationship, but also the capacity to creatively engage with the project, because, you know, you want somebody that's going to help you to realise your vision of the film. And with Ed and myself, it's fantastic that we go back a long way, but that wouldn't mean anything if Ed wasn't a really great producer.
Do you fight?
I think it's fair to say never fight. I mean, we don't.
No, hardly ever.
I don't think we've ever had a major disagreement about
anything.
Okay,
so we don't have it as too much of a love. And what's his weakest point?
That's a really... I should have anticipated that question. It's like interviews, you say, I think my weakest point is I'm too conscientious. I don't think Ed's got any major You know, I'd have to make one up, to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
The other thing is that when I, you know, when I was going through the time where I wasn't really making stuff and Ed was, and I was thinking I could see my contemporaries making films, I was beginning to think I've made, you know, I'm, this is it, it's all going pear-shaped, and I was projecting myself into a sort of an angst-ridden bedsit in 20 years' time. Ed was really always incredibly positive and genuinely positive about me, and that counted for an awful lot, particularly at that point.
Encourage you. You obviously like working with him as a director.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's his weak point?
God, I know it's a very hard question to answer. God,
I can think of a few.
Okay, you tell me what you think it would be.
I don't. I mean, I'm always pessimistic, and maybe sometimes too pessimistic about things. But in another way, maybe that's good. It does force you to really be sure about what you're doing.
But that's also a thing, isn't it, of which you have to do. You know, we all have to do this. You have to kind of imagine the very best and the very worst of what you're about to try to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to kind of live it. And you do that, definitely. It's like in the run-up to any film that we've done, there's been a kind of a moment where Len has gone, this is going to be an absolute disaster and I want out now. How can we get out of this?
But it's probably a good thing to do.
No,
you,
it is,
you imagine the worst case scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always said to people that you can't...
I like that.
You basically don't underestimate the importance of self-doubt and pessimism. Yeah. I mean, we live in a culture where you're supposed to be, you know, it's all about visualizing your goals and all that kind of crap.
All that rubbish.
Yeah, where, you know, you're supposed to be utterly positive about yourself. If you believe it enough, it'll happen. All of which is patently untrue, but people continue to peddle it. And I think what happens is, in the phase of leading up to a film, everybody, it's more comfortable to believe that what you're going to do is it will be amazing, because that makes everybody feel happy.
Yeah.
But if there is a problem, it's better to really deal with it then, and not just gloss over it for the sake of a sort of psychological peace of mind.
Yeah.
And I tend to do that. I tend to be quite rigorous about that process.
I'd see that as a strength. If that's your weakness, that's a strength.
Well, I think it's also, you know, because you can be very tough on stuff, and there are quite a few projects that we've put a lot of time into and worked quite hard on, and that at kind of quite late in the day, Lenny's looked at and gone, actually, no, you know. So there are two or three things that I can think of, which, you know, in one sense, it impedes progress because you're not making as many things as maybe you would otherwise. But in another sense, it's obviously good because you're editing things before they get out there into the world. And definitely you can say that far too many bad films are made in this world. So anything you can do to prevent that is a good thing.
Your latest film, which I think is really moving and delicate, I looked at it last night, what Richard did, it's coming out in the cinemas this weekend, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
What's it about, to tell people?
I mean, it's about a teenage boy. It follows him over the course of a summer, and he's from a middle class South Dublin background, went to a rugby playing school, is a very sort of attractive, the kind of golden boy of his group, the sort of boy that parents would like to be home with their daughters or to have as their sons. And it's about what happens to him when he does something really terrible occurs pretty much in the middle of the film, and it forces us and him to rethink who he really is. And so it's a film about somebody coming face to face with who they really are rather than who they had hoped and thought they might be.
Are there any elements of the Brian Murphy Annabelle's story?
I think I can confidently say that there are no traces of the Annabelle's case. The reason why you're asking the question and why that question will come up is that the film is loosely based on Kevin Parra's book Bad Day in Black Rock, which I think it's fair to say does have echoes of other events and has been fictionalized, but there are echoes of the Annabelle's case. But for me, looking at the book, I think for two reasons, I moved away from the specifics, any specifics that might tie you. First of all, I don't want to make be a forensic filmmaker where you dissect a real event, because in two senses it limits you. First of all, your imagination can't move away from those facts, and I wanted to follow this kid, so I wanted to go where my nose led me. And secondly, I didn't want to make something that would cause more grief to families of people who would have been involved. And so I did some research, you know, about there are sadly a number of cases where deaths occur in the kind of strata that this film looks at, And so the film now, if you didn't know about its history, I don't think anybody would make the link to Annabelle's. But it's something we continually have to address.
And of course, you produced Oma, didn't you? Which obviously is very different. But at the same time, what's it like when you're, I suppose, making a documentary, making a film on a real event as opposed to something completely fictional?
I mean, that was very particular and a very difficult film to be involved in, because we were trying to tell the story of what happened at OMA, but from the point of view of the people who were affected, the OMA support group, which Michael Gallagher ran, basically. And so we had a long engagement with the OMA support group. So I would spend an inordinate amount of time going up and down to OMA, meeting the families, talking to them about their individual stories, the stories of their loved ones, how we would put that into an overall film. One of the most nerve-wracking moments of my professional life was when we showed the film to the families, and happily they felt that the film did capture the spirit of what they've been through.
But it makes it more difficult, doesn't it, when people are alive, in a sense. It's their
incredibly
story.
Difficult. And it's not about, you know, in that world, it's not about kind of, can you legally say that or legally say this? It's actually about, you know, taking the people about whom you're making the film with you, and for them to see it, and for them to believe that it's actually a worthwhile exercise and that it should have been made, and they're happy that it's made. Had there been, you know, something that upset somebody, had they come out against the film, it would have, well, would have made us really reflect on our process and how we got to that stage. But B, it would have been a completely meaningless thing to do, you know, because in a way, I mean, you make films for different people all the time, but certainly that film was made for those people. And if they didn't like it, then it wouldn't have been a success in any way, shape or form.
And they did like it.
They did, I think, yeah.
We're going to take the first piece of music, which reminds you both of your college days, which is David Bowie.
Yeah, so it's David Bowie's Life on Mars. And actually, it's even pre-college days. It's when it's those parties. My sister Emily, that Ed had the
three week
romance with. She loved Bowie, and so this would often be playing in our house when we were having free gaffes when my parents were away. So
he could have been your brother in law.
He could have been my brother in law. It's a near miss, and I thank my lucky stars for it every day. No, I don't.
It's a god awful small affair. To the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen.
David Bowie there with Life on Mars. You both love that song. Reminds you of being young guys growing up in Dublin. Tell me a bit about your background, Ed, first of all. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Ballsbridge, in many ways kind of archetypal leafy suburbs of South County Dublin. And both my mum and my dad were doctors. And I went to Gonzaga. I did made all the kind of right moves, I suppose, that you do when you live in that world.
But you didn't become a doctor.
No, I didn't become a doctor. I suppose I was pretty well informed as to what that life was going to be like, because both my parents were doctors. And I just had a really strong sense that I didn't want to be a doctor. I don't know if that was kind of out of just pure sort of teenage rebelliousness, or whether it was kind of heartfelt, but I think
it's a great image of the Ballsbridge rebellious teenager. I'm not becoming a doctor, father. Yeah. Not like I'm going to join a band or I'm going to become a successful film producer. Yeah. Horror.
Yeah.
But I did when I was in my mid-20s, I did sort of think, God, maybe I should have. But I didn't think that for long.
Did they mind you going into film?
No, not at all.
And Lenny, what about you? You have a very interesting family background.
Yeah, I have an unusual family background, certainly for this country, in that both sets of grandparents came from Eastern Europe, actually from Poland, really, although part of it was not called Poland at that stage. My mother's father came here in the 30s, having travelled across Europe looking for work. He grew up in a shtetl, I mean, a proper fiddler on the roof kind of small Jewish town in the Carpathian Mountains in Poland. There was no work, and he got out of the army and he travelled across Europe and ended up in Belgium and got a job by chance in this bottle making factory, which then opened a branch in Ireland, in Ringsend. and he was a skilled worker, and they sent him here to train the workers and work, which he did for many years in Ringsend. And that's how he came with his wife, and my mum was born just after they arrived. She spoke Yiddish in the home until she was a little bit older and in school. That was her first language. And then my dad's family came a little bit earlier, from a bit further east. My grandfather was about 6 or 7 when he came here with his large family. And actually, amazingly enough, he was very bright and was taken under the wing of the local Christian Brothers School in Newry. And they saw him as you know, academically gifted, and said, "You're going to go down to Trinity College in Dublin and study medicine."
That was so good of them.
It was amazing. Yeah. I mean, they gave him a going away party. I mean, it was extraordinary, a very positive experience, and which you may not have imagined for a small Jewish kid from, you know, from Eastern Europe at that time. And I think to get a scholarship, he did languages first in Trinity. So he was a fluent Irish speaker, and got foundation scholarship in Irish in Trinity, then changed to medicine and became he was professor of medicine in surgeons. And so your father would probably have known him at one point.
Yeah, my father was professor in College of Surgeons, and I think in fact that he told me that there's a portrait of Lenny's grandfather and himself next to each other in the College of Surgeons.
They look not that dissimilar, in that your father looks like a little bit like sort of Edward G. Robinson, I always thought. And my grandfather is also sort of, you know, round headed and a bit lacking in the hair department.
And his name is Lenny Abrahamson.
Yeah,
same as
yeah, that's right. I grew up always with people. He was quite a well known character around Dublin. He was the master of, I think it was the Richmond or hospital, and so lots of older people would say they'd been treated by him or remember him. He was a.
Do you retain your Jewishness? Do you regard yourself now as Jewish?
That particular identity is a really complex one. Mm-hmm. It's not one that you can bow out of, because other people will always identify you as Jewish.
But you wouldn't want to bow out.
No, I wouldn't want to bow out of it, because it is my history and my background. But I'm not religious, and I'm not bringing my children up as Jewish, and that's a very conscious decision. My wife isn't Jewish, and actually, by incredible coincidence, she's Polish. We met at a film festival in Warsaw, so I've two kids who are bilingual. You know, it's a crazy circle that seems to have found some kind of completion. So, I mean, I'm not a believer, even though lots of cultural elements of my childhood are really important to me, and I think they're very valuable. I can't fake it for the sake of giving that particular aspect of the identity to my
kids.
But
I suppose being Jewish isn't about even being just religious. It's about exactly who you are. It's
yes,
in your DNA.
You're right. I mean, and you know, I grew up in very deep in that culture. Mm. I mean, you know, with that grandfather who I was very close to, that's such a link to this now dead and disappeared world. Mm. Those things are, and they eat everything from the food to the sense of humour to the particular kind of, I don't know, yeah. there's a sort of dark humour in
yeah,
the Jewish psyche,
it.
which I really yeah. respond to. So I am in that sense Jewish, absolutely. But I don't go to synagogue, and I don't identify with myself with that religiously at all.
Have you ever gone back, for instance, to visit the shuttle where your grandfather would have left from?
I've been to Poland a lot, obviously, because of my connection. I haven't been down to Stryki Dolny, which is the town he's from. And actually, in Poland, if you want to say, oh, you know, oh God, he's living in Timbuktu, you say, oh, he's gone to Stryki Dolny. It's what you say, actors say to each other, be careful or you'll end up in Repin in Stryki Dolny. It's like, it is a tiny place. But I have been to other towns. But there's nothing of that Jewishness left in those places. You know, those communities were totally wiped out. So my grandfather's...
In the Holocaust.
So my grandfather was from a family of 12, and a few of them got out before the war, including my grandfather. The rest were killed in the camps, bar one or two escapees who... Actually, one only surfaced in the 70s, and he'd been handed out of a cattle train as a 4 or 5 year old boy, and looked after by a farmer, and found his way to Israel in the 70s and put an ad in the Jerusalem Post with the bits that he knew about himself. And my great uncle, who I also knew, spotted it, and it was a reunion.
Ed Gainey is a film producer. I see a film here.
Yeah,
the story is amazing.
Yeah, no, it is amazing. Yeah, no, it is one of the very first things we did years ago when we were just I guess we were just on the cusp of leaving college and starting to work was a documentary about Lenny's grandfather Mendel Waltzman, who he just spoke about there.
Yeah, my grandfather, who was a had worked in a glass bottle factory, got silicosis like lots of them did, and ended up, he ran a butcher shop, a kosher butcher shop on Clanbrassil Street then after that.
Well, we're going to play a clip. Which bit? Which?
We did this interview with him, and he's talking now about thinking about in the late 30s about going back to see his mother in Krakow, which unfortunately he didn't do.
Funny thing, I wanted to go back in 1937 to see my mother, but my first wife, she wasn't well and she wouldn't let me go. When I went to Cook's and they asked me how much was from Dublin to Krakow, there was £12 a ton. You know, that was in 1937. I end on a week, you know. Anyway, I'm the luckiest anyway, because only for taking over here, I would be a gunner, you know. So I'm very, very lucky. Just.
Oh, that was so nice. He's such an unusual accent. It's kind of that mix of Dublin and Eastern European.
And actually, amazingly, a few years after that, myself and my cousin, one of his other grandsons, took him back to a reunion of glass bottle factory workers in the Ringsend Social Club, yeah. You know. And we went in, but everybody was around 70 and my grandfather was mid-80s, and he was going around introducing himself and nobody knew who he was. And just as we were leaving, a door to another room opened and these very old men toddled out. There'd been a sort of a dinner dance for the really old ones. And this man just stopped dead and said, Maxi, which is what they call my grandfather because they couldn't get their heads around Mendel. They started it hugging him and you know, they said one of the lads said to me, you know, I remember when he was in hospital, we used to go in and visit him and we'd bring him all that Jew food, you know, because they'd bring the kosher food. But then one of the guys said that to me and then he suddenly stopped and said, sorry, do you speak English? And it was like, I don't know what he thought about. Maybe we'd all continue to speak Yiddish through the generations of life in Ireland.
But look, we're going to take the next piece of music, which you like, Lenny, which is to do with your Jewish background, the Laurel and Hardy piece.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big vaudeville fan, and that seems to be something deep in the DNA. And this is Laurel and Hardy singing the Trail of the Lonesome Pine. And I remember seeing this as a child and just thinking, I wouldn't have articulated it like that, like this then, but that there was just something really, some beautiful poetry to the movement of these two guys and to the music.
And there is.
On a mountain in Virginia stands a lonesome pine. Just below is the cabin home of a little girl of mine. Her name is June, and very, very soon she'll belong to me.
The wonderful Laurel and Hardy there on the Trail of the Lonesome Pine, your choice, Lenny. You're about to make a big film called Frank, and this weekend your latest film, What Richard Did, is open as well. We mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, we made What Richard Did about a year ago, and actually have just come back from, very recently, just from Toronto, where it had its world premiere, which was very nerve-wracking going into it because it's a massive festival. There's kind of a huge number of films there. It's always a worry whether you kind of make an impression and you stand out. But happily, the film went down incredibly well, got great reviews in the international trade press, particularly Screen and Variety. And it's very gratifying because Jack Rayner, who plays the lead, who plays the character of Richard, Jack is now, I suppose, 20. He was 19 when we made the film, has just gone nuclear in Hollywood. He had all of the Hollywood agents fighting over him.
Oh, good for Jack.
And went straight out to Hollywood after the film screened in Toronto, and I went in to do an audition for DreamWorks for Steven Spielberg's company, and got a call from his agent as he walked out the door saying that went really well. And then 20 minutes later he got a call from Spielberg himself saying, Jack, we'd love you to be in our new film.
That's seriously good.
I think we're going to be great friends for the rest of our lives or something like that.
I'm insisting on a 10% cut of everything Jack gets from now on. That was brilliant because for whatever reason, the attention at Toronto was great, and I think because of this, the film that's happening after the next film, which you alluded to, Frank, which has some big names in it, including Michael Fassbender and Donald Gleeson. Because of that, I got a lot of agent attention as well, which is funny and quite as you would imagine it.
Is it exciting though?
Well, I think if I was a bit younger, my head might turn more. As it is now, I think I will do that, but not until early next year, and I'll be very careful about who I pick. And you know, the agents are quite funny. They some of them really conform to type. I mean, it's
like
they
what,
are absolutely like? Loving you. They are, it is full on, you know, romantic infatuation, except they're also glancing over your shoulder to see who else is walking in the room. I mean, it is as sometimes as apparent as that. But there are some very bright ones and very good ones, and it's something that maybe with Frank behind me, I might think about.
It's probably a far cry from the trailer in Stanford when you were there much younger. But when you get to make a film, I suppose, like this, Frank, with a name like Michael Fassbender, which is a big name out there now, does it mean that it could alter your lives greatly too, if it was a big success?
That's a really good question. Yes, it would. You know, even the knowledge that film is being made does affect the kinds of ways in which you're talked about and the sort of projects that come to you even before the film is made. And if it's a success, because that's ultimately how, in a very harsh way, the industry judges things. But if it is a success, yeah, it would allow me to make... I mean, I want to make films that I want to make. I don't want to just make bigger films for their own sake. But some of the projects I have do happen to be bigger, and that would allow me to do that.
Did you have to chase Michael, or did he want to do this?
No,
project?
I mean, it was kind of extraordinary, really, because we were just beginning the process of casting and thinking about, you know, who we would have in the film. It's quite a difficult part to cast. It's quite challenging. And we just got a phone call one day from his agent saying that he had read the script. And so, yeah, we had this call, and that was, you know.
And you said, no, we don't want him.
It was one of those great serendipitous moments. I think Michael's sort of very interested in writing and is interested in producing himself. So I think he likes to know what's going on. He likes to know what's out there. And, you know, he read it, and he'd worked with Lenny before. They'd done a commercial together. So obviously he knew what he'd be getting into. And
it's a great stamp of approval, though, and confidence in you as well, though, Lenny.
Yeah, it's true, because, you know, ultimately the actor buys into two things, I suppose, the script and the director. But it is a nice thing when good people want to work with you.
When do you start shooting Frank?
We start shooting Frank in about 10 weeks. It's about 5 weeks in Ireland and about just over two weeks in the States. Without trying to explain it too much, it's quite an extraordinary story about a guy who joins a band, wants to be in a band, gets into this very peculiar avant-garde band, bites off more than he can chew, and the band is led by Frank, who's this bipolar kind of outsider musician who wears a fake head. So it'll be Michael Fassbender in a fake head for a big proportion of the film.
A challenge.
Yeah, it's a challenge, that's for sure.
Well, given how successful you've both been so far, I reckon Frank will also be a big hit. Just as we close, you both become fathers late enough in life.
Yes, you know, I was 44 when I had my 2-year-old, and it's, as these things do, utterly changed my life. And he's a delightful, gorgeous child.
I've got a 4-year-old boy called Max and a little girl called Nell who's 1.5. And the good thing is that Ed is somebody I can always be sure I can bore the arse off with pictures of my children, and he doesn't object, because he can do the same with his.
Did it change you both being fathers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, apart from the fact that there's just less time, you know, but it definitely did. It really did.
In what way?
I don't know. You do. I mean, I've heard people say this before, but you really do get a sense of your own mortality. You do have a sense of kind of this, you know, humans refreshing themselves, and that this person that, you know, you've given birth to is going to be here long after you've gone, and you know, and you really want the best for him, and to give him every possible chance, and for him to be happy and confident and lucky in life.
I, from my point of view, it has, yeah, all the things that Ed says, and also I think in making what Richard did, thinking about the boy who's 18 or 19 in the film, mm-hmm. I think I had a very different relationship to that character, because I had my own children and my own little boy, and you can't help but project your own children into the lives of other people, or I think it intensifies whatever empathy you may have for other people when you have your own children.
Since you're both creatives, do you think having the children in your 40s unlocks emotions even, or creativity?
I would say in my case, yeah, I do feel more. I think in certain areas of my life feel things more intensely because I've got kids, and also it takes some of, not all maybe unfortunately, but some of the self-absorption lifts when you have children, because they demand you, and that's an unconditional demand, and unless you're an awful person, it's one that you have to meet and want to meet, and so that's a healthy change for me.
You bet.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, I think what Lenny said about empathy is true. I mean, the other thing that I really feel is that's changed for me is time. I mean, everything feels so much more pressured, and you know, there's just less time in the day. And I think that it kind of makes you more focused. It makes you kind of more clear about what you feel is worth putting your time and energy into, and what isn't.
Well, that's all really nice, actually. Well, look, What Richard Did, your latest film, is in cinemas nationwide from this weekend. The last song, Ed, you've chosen, Marvin Gaye?
Yeah, it's a song that I've loved forever. I mean, I've sort of fallen in and out of love with other bits of music through my life, but I've always loved this. And it just came back to mind recently because Lenny and I were in New Orleans looking at locations for this new film, and we went into a club on Bourbon Street, and it was early in the day, actually, but this was blasting out, and I just brought it back to me. Yeah, what a wonderful song it is.
Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. Lenny Abrahamson, Ed Guiney, thank you very much for being my guest this morning. Best of luck with everything you do in the future. My thanks and sound today to Sheila Neve Wheel, to my producer Eileen Heron. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we'll go out listening to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
On RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.